Joining me is Adrian Warner, who runs Avenir Capital in Sydney, Australia. Adrian has a background in private equity and was very successful in that investment field prior to starting Avenir Capital, which is a value-oriented investment firm in public markets. Adrian, I'd like to learn from you about your path and kind of what motivated you to make the switch from private equity to public equity.
My background, as you outlined, was in private equity, and I've spent close to 20 years in the private equity industry, both in Australia but also in the US. I started out in private equity in the early 90s, having spent a number of years at Bain & Company in consulting. I should probably back up and start by saying my education was during the 80s, when the efficient market hypothesis was at its peak, and so I did a first-class honours degree in finance, where I had it drilled into me very firmly that public markets were efficient and there was really no way to effectively beat the public markets over the long term. With that backdrop, I sought other ways to apply investing in markets I felt were less efficient. And private equity in the early 90s was such a place where it was still a fairly small and under the radar industry, and there were great opportunities in that market to hunt out bargains and hunt out businesses that were available for much less than I felt that they were worth. That industry didn't really exist in the Australian market, and so I had to move to the US to really participate in that industry. And it was a wonderful industry for many years because it was entrepreneurial, it was under the radar, and there were a range of great bargains that people could buy, businesses that others didn't want because of short-term issues they had, or there were just simply no buyers because of other factors that might have been at play. And for many years, it was a productive and profitable industry. I then moved back to Australia, just as the private equity industry was really starting to get some traction in this market. And we were able to replicate the success of the earlier days in the US and the Australian market. And I joined a group ultimately called CVC Asia Pacific, which is backed by the CVC Capital Partners Group out of London. And in the Australian market in the late 90s and during the early part of the decade of the 2000s, we had the market to ourselves, and we were able to do a range of very successful deals of increasing size. Again, it was a very inefficient market. But then what happened was a lot of the larger international groups, such as TPG and KKR and Carlyle and Bain & Company and a range of others, moved into the market. And what had been a somewhat inefficient market suddenly became incredibly efficient and incredibly institutionalized. And it became very hard to find cheap ideas and to buy businesses that were solid businesses with good prospects for a reasonable price. And the infrastructure grew up around the industry, so there were suddenly lots of advisors from legal, accounting, banking, all who knew how the private equity model worked, what drove returns, how we would structure transactions, and every transaction became intermediated, so you always had an advisor of some kind between the buyer and the seller, increasing the levels of efficiency in relation to pricing. So I started looking around and thinking, well, where was the next evolution of investing? And the private equity market had become incredibly efficient, and I'd always felt that the public market was incredibly efficient. But I started really looking at the public market with a fresh perspective, and perhaps 20 years late in view of some people, the epiphany, I guess, that I had was that there were tremendous pockets of inefficiency in the public market due to an increasingly short-term orientation in the public market investing world, and just the human nature that more powerfully comes to the fore in a market that is very liquid with continual public access to pricing and availability of liquidity. Human nature and human emotions come to the fore much more than they can in private equity, and can drive these short-term dislocations in price. And so for me, it was somewhat of an eye-opener 20 years down the road, having dismissed the public market for that time, to suddenly become a firm believer that there were tremendous opportunities in the public market to take a private equity mentality take some of the principles of private equity and apply it to the public market. And I felt that could be actually a very powerful a very powerful investing combination. So that's what we've set out to do with Avenir Capital, really apply some of the key elements of private equity investing, but apply it to the much deeper opportunity set and much greater liquidity available in the public markets.
And to what extent do you invest in the Australian public markets versus elsewhere globally?
Well, when we set the business up, we wanted to maximize the opportunities available to us to find bargains. And one of the things that we focus on intensely is to really focus only on those investment situations where we think there's an extreme mispricing, an extreme dislocation between price and our view of value. And so to best do that, we didn't want to limit the playing field. So we've chosen a global strategy. While we certainly can invest in Australian opportunities, and we have, we're just of the view that there is a big world out there and a much greater opportunity to uncover bargains if you have a broader perspective on the playing field that you can operate within. And so we've chosen a global strategy. At the moment, probably about 20% of our fund is invested in Australian assets. There's probably about 50% invested in the US, and then there's the remainder is probably split between Europe and Asian opportunities, if we exclude cash. So we wanted to keep it as broad as possible to allow us to hunt out those bargains wherever we could find them.
So maybe we can talk about applying a private equity mindset to public markets. What does that really mean in your view, and how does it differentiate you from perhaps some of the other participants in public markets?
Yeah, well, one of the things we've observed in the public market is that there seems to be an ever-increasing short-termism in the way that people invest, and the entire industry seems to be structured around that, where people become incredibly fearful of deviating from whatever their relevant benchmark might be, even for the short term, as there's a whole infrastructure of gatekeepers and advisors and fund ratings groups who will pounce on that and start to recommend to their clients that perhaps that fund isn't such a great idea because they've fallen behind the benchmark for a relatively short period of time, or their volatility in terms of month-to-month variations and asset value is perhaps greater than someone anticipated. And so there's this continual, it seems to us, this continual pressure, this institutional imperative to avoid doing that. And when you avoid doing that, what you essentially do is start to become like everybody else and either try to pick those things that you think will increase in price the most in the short term. And the only way you can try to do that is by guessing what other people will think about the price of an asset. And to us, that's just a very ineffective and difficult way to achieve returns in the long term. So we felt, coming from a private equity background where the time frames are much longer in private equity. So what I think private equity does well is, firstly, focuses on the downside first and worries a lot about the probability or the possibility of losing capital in any investment. Private equity portfolios are concentrated. They generally employ fairly large amounts of debt, so if things go wrong, they can go very wrong very quickly. So there's a great deal of emphasis on worrying about what can go wrong in any investment in private equity, which I think is a very healthy starting point, and fixating on avoiding permanent loss of capital. So that's probably the first element of private equity I think we really work very hard on bringing over to the public markets. Private equity focuses obviously on, it's a very opportunistic business, and so it's very focused on fundamental, bottom-up, deep research approach to investment selection, which to us makes complete sense. And I think if you can remove yourself from trying to second guess stock prices and actually just focus on what you see as the underlying or intrinsic value of an asset, and look to invest only in those situations when you can buy at a very material discount to that. That bottom-up approach to us is central to what we do, and I think it's, again, very consistent with a private equity background. And probably thirdly, in private equity, the private equity industry focuses on absolute long-term returns. There are no benchmarks in the short term. There is no liquidity or daily pricing of assets. And so the focus is very much on what can you buy an asset for now, and what do you think you'll be able to sell it for in 3, 4, or 5 years time, and not worry too much about what's going to happen to the price in the short term. And I think that absolute long-term return focus is very powerful, rather than, I think, a lot of the public market industry, which is trapped in this relative benchmarking mindset, which can be very damaging, I think, to focusing on long-term return. So it's really those three pillars, I guess, that we focus on in our program, which is focusing on the downside first, being very fundamental and bottom-up in our approach to investment selection, and taking a focusing on an absolute long-term return rather than worrying about short-term performance and short-term volatility. I think those things allow us to differentiate from many in the market who have grown up investing in the public markets, where they've been continually exposed to the pressures of needing to keep up with your benchmark in the short term, which, if you don't do something different from the benchmark, then by definition you can't outperform it in the long term. And I think that's how we try to bring our private equity mentality and apply it to the public market.
In terms of the balance sheets themselves, you alluded to it that in private equity, you obviously look to increase equity returns by layering on leverage. Now, when you invest in the public markets, are you still looking for companies that have that kind of component to the return? Are you looking for leveraged businesses, or do you try to avoid them, or does it not really matter either way?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because when we tell people that we're trying to bring this private equity approach to the public market, they think of two things. They think of one, leverage, and that we're going to use leverage in our investments, and two, they think of control, and are we an activist fund? And really neither of those two things. I think one of the things you do give up in applying in investing in the public markets in most cases is you do give up control, and that's a very powerful element of private equity, and that's something that we can see that we don't have in most investments that we make in the public market. But that's a trade-off we're prepared to make, given that we have the opportunity to buy things at half price, and we have the liquidity to change our mind and change our position sizing should we see fit. But if you don't have control, it makes leverage a very dangerous thing. And so we're extremely cautious of leverage. We don't use leverage in the fund, so the fund is not leveraged in any way. In certain circumstances, we will invest in companies that have perhaps more than a normal amount of leverage for a public market company, but that's relatively rare. In most cases, we're quite reluctant to invest in situations that have a lot of leverage, because we've witnessed firsthand in our private equity career that can be incredibly damaging, and if you don't have control, there's not a lot you can do about it. So we are very cautious of leverage. The only situations where we will invest in situations with some leverage is for businesses that we think are above average in terms of quality and in terms of predictability and stability of cash flow. So we try not to use leverage as a generator of, or a magnifier of, returns, because that works both ways. And in general, we try to look for opportunities where the business is well capitalized, it has a strong balance sheet, and we're just able to buy that business at a very cheap price. And that's what generates the returns for us, not the use of leverage. In some situations, leverage can be beneficial, but it's something that we're very cautious of. And in fact, most of our investments, you'd see that leverage is not really an important part of the thesis. And in fact, most of the businesses that we've invested in have very strong, often cash positive balance sheets.
One other important criterion, I think, for private equity investors is the management team that's put in charge of a company. And many of the best public equity investors also look for highly incentivized, capable management teams. I assume that's also a part of your strategy. How do you actually go about assessing management? What kind of What kind of indicators, if you will, do you look at to decide whether you found a management team that to whom you want to entrust your capital?
Well, in private equity, we one of the ways that private equity has been in general successful over the last decade or two is by being very generous in the way it treats its management teams of its portfolio companies, and by being generous in a sensible and thoughtful manner. So not just showering them with cash, but providing them with attractive equity programs that do align their interests with those of the shareholders. And so I've seen firsthand in many occasions the power of that, and how a simple but carefully structured management equity program can drive very powerful and positive behavior from management teams. And so that's something that I spend quite a lot of time in trying to assess in making investments, to understand who are the important stakeholders in that investment, whether it's management or indeed it might be other shareholders. Where are they? How are they aligned in terms of economic incentives? Do the management team own a significant stake in the business? Are the management team regular and sizable buyers of shares on their own account? And those things are very important. And I've been burnt in the past in a couple of situations where I've made the mistake of investing in situations where that alignment was very poor or very weak. And then you start to see behavior that is arguably not focused with shareholders' interests in mind, but focused with the manager's interests in mind. And if they're not aligned, that can be very damaging when you don't have control. So, it is very difficult to assess management from the outside. In the public market environment, you don't generally get to spend a great deal of time with management, and time you do spend with management is fairly carefully curated and controlled in terms of time and the forum in which it occurs, and often you're getting canned speeches from people who have given that speech many times before. They want to say what you want to hear, and they're very good at doing that. So I think you have to be very careful in how you interact with management and what you take away from that, because you're seeing one slice of the management team in a very controlled setting. And if you don't have a history with them or the ability to go back in history and see what they've done in previous situations, then it can be very difficult to make a very accurate assessment of their capabilities and which particular areas they're going to focus and how they're going to think about capital allocation and how they're going to think about shareholder interest. And so really the clearest and I think the strongest way you can do that is understand their economic incentives and understand whether they are material owners of shares alongside the shareholders. And that's something that I know from first-hand experience in private equity is very powerful in aligning interests. And I think that's the best way, even in the public market, to ensure you're going to have a manager group who are thinking about you as a shareholder, because they're a shareholder alongside you.
Adrian, could you perhaps give us an example of a company that maybe is representative of the type of business you seek out and what you look for, and maybe let us know how the investment evolved after you made it?
Yeah, sure. Well, we try to keep things fairly simple. We do have a very broad canvas in which we can operate, and we have an international focus. And so no matter what's happening at a macro level or no matter what's happening with the markets, there's always opportunities to find something that's mispriced. And a big part of what we do is just rummage around in any area that we can to find those few and those select examples of mispricing. That's all we need to put together a portfolio. And one example that we still own at the moment is an Australian business called Collins Foods. It's a KFC franchisee. It's really the only KFC franchisee in the state of Queensland, which is one of the largest states in Queensland. They were owned by a private equity group, interestingly enough, for a number of years, and they were listed on the Australian Stock Exchange in the middle of 2011. And what one of the curious characteristics of private equity exits in the Australian market is that historically the private equity group has exited 100%, whereas it's more normal in other markets, including the US, for private equity or investment groups to be exiting to maintain a stake and to sell down a partial stake at an initial IPO and then over time exit their position. In the Australian market, what's historically happened is people have got out 100%, which has meant that on occasion, the private equity industry as a group has been accused of perhaps gilding the lily somewhat in these private equity exits, selling out 100% and then buyers in the IPO suffering the consequences of an underperforming stock price over time. And this was an example where the private equity group exited. The company put out forecasts in a prospectus in the middle of 2011, and then within a few months of the IPO, management revised down the prospectus forecast by a fairly sizable 20 to 25%. And as you can imagine, that was very poorly received by the market. I think that was exacerbated by the fact it was a private equity firm that was exiting, and so the investors reacted with a mixture of shock and anger and embarrassment that they'd been taken in by private equity again, because it wasn't the first time it had happened in the Australian market. And management lost a fair amount of credibility, and the stock, which had listed at $2.50 a share, which was around a $250 million market cap at the time of listing, collapsed very quickly and then continued to drop until the stock price settled around just over a dollar. So Collins had about 93 million shares out, so at just over a dollar, the market cap had fallen from close to 250 million to around 100 million. It was reasonably well capitalized, so there was about 90 million of debt, but that was only about just under 2x EBITDA. So it wasn't an over-leveraged situation. And the management team hadn't sold anything in the IPO, and they owned as a group about 8% of the business. So there was still that economic alignment between shareholders and management. But that company was being panned in the press on a daily basis. It was the worst IPO of the year and the biggest IPO flop of the year and fund manager embarrassment, and really no one wanted to have that stock in their books. No one wanted to go to their boss at the end of the year and say, we own Collins Foods and it's dropped 60% in price and we bought it off these private equity guys and we made a bit of a mistake. So people were just selling it left, right and center. And that's the kind of situation we look for, where you've got a fairly simple business to understand. Not much has really changed in the business, but there are circumstances around the business that mean there's this forced selling or somewhat irrational selling. And that's really how we've been able to generate our best ideas. So we looked at that and saw a business that was well managed operationally, despite the fact that the prospectus forecast had been reduced materially. The earnings of the business weren't going to be materially behind the last few years of earnings. And so the forecast in the IPO showed a fairly significant upturn in earnings. That was revised down, and while the earnings were below anticipated to be below the last few years of earnings, they weren't a material reduction, and there was nothing fundamentally wrong with the business. And we looked at that, we looked at that business and felt it could generate around $18 million of free cash flow a year, and it was trading at about $100 million of market cap, fairly well capitalized. Well run, with a management team who own 8% of the business, so fully aligned. And it felt to us that a 20% cash flow yield or not much more than 5x PE, that was too cheap for a business of this nature. It also had some growth options in terms of new stores and store refurbishments, which historically they'd achieved very good returns on capital. So we felt that there was the opportunity to continue to get some earnings growth out of the business, but you really didn't need that to make a return. So we started buying that just over a dollar. Shortly after we bought it, they paid a 6.5 cent dividend, so our all-in price was around a dollar, and it's up around $1.80 today. We think fair value is probably something around $1.80 to $2, and so we're probably close to starting to to exit that. And all that's really happened is a bit of time's gone by. The dust has been allowed to settle. When you actually stopped and stood back from the noise and the press reports, you saw a business that was, it was a reasonable quality business. It had a, had a strong position in a competitive industry, but a reasonably strong position, and had, was being well run operationally. And there just seemed to us to be a disconnect where if you're paying 5x earnings for a KFC franchise, you can't go too far wrong. And that's proven to be the case so far, where that investment's up about 80%, and we think it's probably getting back to something approaching fair value now.
And how do you actually think about valuation? What are some of the key financial metrics you look at to ascertain equity value?
Well, we always, probably our first and most important metric is purely free cash flow. We're always very keen to see what cash is being generated by the business after CapEx, after interest payments, after tax, what cash is coming through to the equity holders. And if we can buy something for 5, 6, 7x cash flow in a business that's not declining or facing structural challenges, then we think that that's a good starting point, assuming that the balance sheet is fairly robust and the capital structure is fairly robust. And when we think about exit, we try, for a business like a Collins Foods, we try to be very conservative in terms of what we're thinking about from an exit point of view. And so, historically, we've looked at something like 10x free cash flow as a reasonable assumption for an exit. And if we can buy it at a price and assume 10x free cash flow on the exit and double our money under those assumptions, then that starts to look like a potentially very interesting investment for us. But having said that, one of the things we've increasingly done over time is raise our standards in terms of the quality of the businesses that we'll invest in. And where we've had our mistakes in the past has been in investing in businesses where the quality has just been too poor. And something's been tremendously cheap on a statistical basis, but even if the business is not deteriorating or structurally flawed, it's just a poor quality business or a lower quality business with very limited barriers to entry. And so what we've gradually done over time is increase the threshold for the nature of businesses that we'll invest in. And that means, at times we are prepared to pay a higher price for a business that's a much better quality. But we're still very much value investors at heart, and we look at private market value, what we think a sensible, rational, and conservative third party, including private equity, might pay for a business, and that often comes down to what multiple of operating earnings people might be prepared to buy. But we apply a very conservative filter to that, because if you're in ebullient or enthusiastic times, then you'll see people paying prices for businesses that make no sense in the long term, and we have to be cautious not to extrapolate some transaction values that have occurred in the market and say, well, that's a reasonable value, we'll assume that for an exit, because at times the market's irrational, at times transactions get done at irrational levels. So we always try to anchor it back to free cash flow in general, in one form or another, what cash is coming out of the business, how predictable is it, and we're trying to buy very low multiples of that cash flow.
I know you're a bottom-up investor, and ultimately investing is all about the individual companies that you purchase, but since you mentioned this notion of going up on the quality scale, could you tell us what types of businesses you consider of lesser quality, or are there any industries that you consciously try to avoid getting involved with?
Yeah, well, in the private equity world, it's a very opportunistic industry, and so my background, my training has been to be very open to most areas, and to have the confidence we can that we can understand the issues around any industry, well, the important issues around any industry and any investment. But having said that, there are some areas which I just personally feel very uncomfortable and generally avoid. And one of those is resources. I find resource stocks very hard to understand. Coming from Australia, there's plenty of them around here. But they're very hard, I find, to make a sensible and credible assessment of what they're really worth. And there are too many variables involved to get comfortable with even coming up with some range of potential values. And the starting point for our investment process is if we can't come up with a credible view of what something might be worth, even if it's a range, then we can't determine whether there's a significant enough dislocation between price and that value. And so resources is an area where I think they're prone to nasty surprises and too many variables around the quality of the assets that they own, operational issues, the need to raise further funding in a dilutive manner, just when you least want to do it. All of those issues, I think, make resources hard to invest in, so I'm cautious about that as an area. Retail, I find challenging. I just think it's like many people. There is a fine line between a successful retailer and a struggling retailer in terminal decline, and from the outside, it can be very hard to determine where that fine line actually is. And without having the same flow of information that you can get in a private equity setting, and without having control over management and who's running the operation that you can have in a private equity setting, I think as a public market investor, I find retail as a space that I treat very cautiously. But outside of areas like that, what we tend to be looking for is reasonable quality businesses with reasonable predictability of cash flows, and a relatively limited rate of change in the industry. It's as Warren Buffett said, that change is the enemy of the investor, and in many cases we believe that as well. If we're looking at a business that operates in an industry where there's a lot of change going on, and it's difficult for us to understand where that change might lead, then we just think there are plenty of opportunities elsewhere and they go into the too hard basket.
One of the attractions of private equity, obviously, is the ability to have control. How do you kind of make peace with the fact that you are somewhat more passive in the public markets and that you cannot affect the types of actions, whether it's on the business side or on the capital allocation side of these management teams?
Yeah, control is a wonderful thing. Control is a very powerful thing, and you can invest in situations that you wouldn't otherwise invest in if you have control. And I certainly don't underestimate the power of control, and I think that's one of the great strengths of private equity, is having that control. And we do give that up. I concede that it is a material benefit to give up that control by investing in the public market. But where we benefit and what we make up, on the other hand, in terms of not having to pay a premium for control at a minimum, often being able to buy at a discount to fair value. So not only not paying a premium for control, in most cases, and in fact in all cases, we're not even paying fair value in our view. So we're buying at a material discount to fair value. And yeah, there is really, I think, no more powerful way to generate safe and satisfactory returns than by paying the right price for any investment, whether you have control or not. And the ability to buy things tremendously cheaply in the public market, I think, makes up for that lack of control. And the other thing is the public market provides liquidity. And in private equity, when you buy something, you're often stuck with it for quite a few years. It's not easy to turn around and sell it if you change your mind, or 6 months or a year down the road, you find that things weren't quite as you anticipated. In the public market, you can. You have that liquidity as not necessarily at the price you want, but you can make a decision that you've got better opportunities elsewhere, or the investment thesis that you made your investment on no longer holds, or you made a mistake. You have got that liquidity, which is a very powerful thing that doesn't exist in private equity. So giving up control is serious, it's real, but I think that we more than make up for that by being able to buy things very cheaply and by having the liquidity to switch our capital to other areas that present a more asymmetric return to risk profile if we so choose.
And you mentioned that you don't consider yourself an activist investor, but do you occasionally try to influence management or at least let them know your views?
But we certainly seek to let our views be known. Again, having spent almost 20 years in private equity and having a very real and a very big seat at the table by being in a position of control, you don't change your stripes entirely. And so we're not shy in letting management or boards know what we think or whether we think that they're making missteps. I think what we certainly don't do is describe ourselves as activists. The opportunity set is so wide that I think if you put on the activist hat too firmly, you run the risk of only looking for those situations where you can spoil it for a fight and you have conflict, and it feels to us that there are enough opportunities out there where management and board are doing the right thing, and we can either be passive investors or we can benefit from the activities of others who are being more vocal or more active in the way they're engaging with the company. So we're certainly not shy in benefiting from investing in those opportunities where others are trying to bring about change. But it's not something that we've focused on ourselves. I think that over time there will be situations where we feel the need to get a bit more pointed with managements or boards, but I suspect that they will more be cases where we're already invested in a situation and we think the right things aren't happening, or there's some capital allocation decisions from management that we disagree with, and we're already a party to that investment. So in those situations, we'll perhaps seek to get more involved. But what we don't intend to do is necessarily start out by looking for ideas that require an activist hand at the wheel. I think if you do that, you run the risk that you limit your view to those situations and miss out all these wonderful opportunities where people are doing the right thing and circumstances have conspired to create a great opportunity to buy a decent quality business at a great bargain, and you don't need to be cracking the whip.
And how do you go about generating ideas to look into further on a global scale?
Look, the idea generation is a very important part of what we do, and it's one it's difficult to be too scientific about, to be honest. I mean, we get ideas from a range of sources. We do a tremendous amount of reading. A large part of our time is reading all sorts of, whether it's magazines, SEC filings, conference call transcripts, sell side research. Yeah, there are groups such as your own Manual of Ideas, which are wonderful sources of almost curated ideas and pre-screened ideas. And so we make sure that we're tapped into the better ones of those to use that as a source of idea generation. But a big part of it is making sure that your antenna is attuned to those situations where you think there might be opportunity. And the starting point for us in generating ideas is to seek those areas where we think that there are going to be forced sellers or panicked sellers and irrational sellers in some way. And so they're the kinds of situations that we look for. And so whether we're reading newspapers, watching the news, talking to colleagues and other investors, our antenna are always tuned to anything that we think might create an opportunity where someone's selling something for the wrong reason, and there's a wave of selling for the wrong reason. So that's really where we start. We're looking for blood in the water in many cases to find those circumstances where we're going to find that extreme mispricing. The industry's changed a lot in the last 5 years because there's no substitute for just the legwork, and if you don't enjoy doing that reading and scrounging around, then I don't think you can hope to be very successful, because that's a big part of what we do, is just continually searching and hunting for ideas. And if you don't enjoy that hunt and don't enjoy reading all of these original sources, then I think you'll find it hard to maintain the passion and the focus in doing so. But the industry has changed a lot. There are groups like Manual of Ideas and others who recognize that there's this voracious market out there who are desperate for good ideas and can create viable businesses in trying to help surface the best ideas to the market. And I think that it's, in a way, it creates more efficiency in the market, which is not necessarily a good thing. But from an idea generation point of view, it can be very powerful. And there are, I think, a whole range of avenues that you can tap into that didn't exist 5 years ago to just be continually throwing up ideas. And you can sift through those and see which ones resonate with your own approach, your own strategy. As always, we go back to original documents and original sources to develop our own thesis. But the world has changed, and I think there are a lot of ways to tap into a good flow of ideas, particularly internationally, that didn't exist 5 years ago.
As we wrap up the conversation, I'd like to talk a little bit about how you're building your firm. One thing that I found very interesting is the fee structure. I believe you don't charge a management fee, but take a performance fee over a 6% hurdle. What motivated you to set up that kind of a structure?
Excuse me. Look, when we set out, I guess we were looking to offer something a little bit different. We were looking to try and bring a little bit of innovation to the market and to provide an investment vehicle that offered people something a bit different. And so, firstly, we felt that the idea of bringing a private equity mentality to bear on the public market is something that others have done before us, but I think it's still relatively in its infancy in trying to bring that approach to the market. So that was the first thing we felt was different. Our background was different. We've not grown up in the public market industry, and so we've not been swayed or molded by the pressures that having worked in that industry for 20 years can subtly bring to bear on people. So I think that's actually quite a powerful differentiating factor. And we were also looking for a way on the fee structure to say, well, we're prepared to back ourselves to generate good, sensible returns in a safe and insane manner. So we looked at what other people were doing, and there were people like Monish Pabre who enjoy watching what he's doing, and he openly stole his fee structure from the early Buffett partnerships of the 50s and 60s. And so we thought, well, we'll steal our fee structure from Pabre funds, who have in turn stolen it from Buffett. And if you do that, you can't go too far wrong in a fee structure. And it felt like our way to provide a different product to investors, where we're essentially saying, if we don't generate at least a 6% return per annum, which is really meant to be a nominal cash rate, if we don't generate that for our investors, then we don't deserve to get paid, and we shouldn't get paid. But we back ourselves to be able to do that. So we're prepared to get no management fee and no performance fee, no fee of any kind, if we don't make at least 6% per annum for our investors, because if we can't do that, then they should just be putting their money in the bank. And it also aligned with our strategy, which is to only invest. You know, we like to be very selective, so we only invest in those situations in which we think that the downside risk is very low, and we can stand a very good chance of doubling our money in 2 or 3 years. And if we can't find that opportunity, then we'll just leave our money in cash, and we think there's great option value in cash. But we don't expect people to be paying us for keeping their money in cash despite the fact we think there's real value in having that discipline if you can't find the best opportunity. So to the extent we have money sitting in cash in the fund, people aren't being charged for that. And so that was a second element to not charging fees below 6%. And the quid pro quo is that if we do well, we take a performance fee. You know, once the fund generates above 6%, we take a performance fee of 25% of the increase in net asset value. So it works out that the fee structure equates to a 2-in-20 structure when you get to very high rates of return, a typical 2-in-20 structure. But investors get that protection on the downside below 6%, where they're not being charged anything by the manager, because we don't feel we deserve it at that point. And the other thing we do is that I personally have got the bulk of my own family's money in the fund, and so that gives people comfort that we're protecting that money very carefully. And our first goal is to make sure that we're able to give investors their money back when they want it. And then our secondary goal is to try and generate a good and above market return over time. And because my and my family's money is in the fund, we align our investment decisions with our other investors, because it's we're not just there to make a fee, we're there to generate returns out of the fund and to protect our own capital. So we take a very cautious view to investing. We think that fund structure is a sensible one. It makes sense for investors, it makes sense for us, and it's one that's proven to be very popular.
Great. Well, on that note, Adrian, I do want to thank you very much for taking the time to share with us your insights into private equity style investing in public markets, and also some background on your firm. Thanks very much.